Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Tim.
And this is Get On Board, a podcast about games worth playing.
Join us every week for great analysis on board games, pick fives, reviews, and all sorts of other entertaining board game talk. Well, welcome to our first ever cooperative game extravaganza, a cooperative game special where we're going to ask really the core question, what makes a cooperative game fun?
My subjective opinion.
Yeah, well, we're going to go a little bit more in depth. But actually, we've put a lot of effort into this. Andrew and I both put together a spreadsheet of all the co-op games that we've played and different factors surrounding them. And it was a really helpful exercise. Analyzing cooperative games, for me, turns out to be more difficult than analyzing competitive games. Did you find that to be true?
No.
Really?
Tell me why. I'm curious.
Okay, it's just that element of the AI that's thrown on there. When you're sort of analyzing a competitive game, you can think about, well, this is how the players are supposed to play it. And so you would sort of predict this kind of interaction, right? But then you sort of add this element of this AI and how players would respond to it. And really, it's kind of a dumb mechanism.
Interesting.
That's got a sort of, you know, interacting with that mechanism is going to have to make the game more interesting. And I think that just makes it more difficult for me to assess, maybe.
It's funny. I would actually say the exact opposite of what you just said.
Wow.
I think that, and this is not a knock against co-ops, but I think that the very nature of their programmed puzzle, whether that's a deck of cards or a storybooklet or what have you, that will be the same experience every time you come back to it, which is fine. I enjoy that. I play these games repeatedly for the experience they offer. But I think the variability and the unpredictability of a game comes when you open up the competitive side of things. Right. So I actually find a co-op game easier to pin down a little bit because I find it easier to grok, okay, what are we supposed to be doing? What is intended to happen at this point? Because our opponent is not another player who has whims and changes and is variable, but a game that's been pre-programmed to react in a certain way to our actions.
And maybe it's because in the grand scheme of things, I've just played a lot more competitive games than I have cooperative games.
That could be.
And so I guess I'm more familiar with the different types of mechanics that are present in competitive games. I think cooperative games are still very much a forming genre.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of see that pull up in the last 10, 15 years, really, that they've come to exist, and with a few exceptions.
It also seems to happen that one co-op game will come out and sort of push a new idea, and then everybody will jump on that idea. And yeah, I know this happens in competitive games too. But
Dominion.
Yeah. So, but, you know, Action Point Allocation, Pandemic style, you know,
right.
Oh my goodness.
Right.
You know, when that came out, you know, there are a whole bunch of games that followed that did very similar things and some with decent result. But maybe that's part of it too, is that there just isn't enough in the genre yet to really, or as much to compare to as we would in a cooperative game world. But there is a really important question about cooperative games. There are a couple of factors that people who don't like cooperative games often pull out and say,
right.
Or maybe I wouldn't say don't like cooperative games, but have had negative experiences with them.
Sure.
Pull out and say, but you know, this is what I don't like about cooperative games.
Sure.
I can almost hear, if I were to ask the question to our listening audience right now, and if I could magically hear across space and time all the thousands, dozens, tens of listeners saying it's the alpha gamer
problem. It's the alpha player. Yep.
I've been thinking about this recently and listened to a review or a podcast or something where some interesting terminology was used.
Yeah,
tell us about that.
It was a review by Shut Up and Sit Down, the ever-brilliant crew over there.
Mm-hmm.
And alpha players, everyone's experienced them. Several of us have been them, depending on the game.
Mm-hmm.
It's never pleasant. It really sours that whole cooperative aspect to the game. And
for those who are not familiar with the term, what is that? What is alpha player?
I mean, other people call it quarterbacking, someone who's dominating the game and basically playing it by themselves using all the other players to do exactly what they want. So someone who has a very dominant personality or an aggressive personality is basically bossing everyone else around. And because it's a cooperative game and that person's often the most assertive or articulate around the table, everyone listens to them and we just all play it their way. Totally destroys the spirit of what a cooperative game is supposed to be. I play a cooperative game for the camaraderie, for the teamwork, to make friends, to be with people, and a player just totally upends all of that, which is why I hate the tendency in myself, and I try to knock it down whenever I can. But I would actually say I think cooperative game designers are working really hard to counteract this problem lately. We've seen a lot of interesting efforts to kind of tear it down, because I would say, perhaps, maybe this is obvious from the name, but the core of a co-op game is people working together. It's cooperation.
Right.
It's people who want to work together to solve this, to solve the situation or to win the game or what have you. But it's that camaraderie. It's the teamwork.
And I think the terminology that Shut Up and Sit Down used that you told me was cooperative versus coercive.
Yes.
That a game becomes coercive when it kind of gives into that or allows for the possibility of that mechanic of or that that player, excuse me, sort of running the show. Some games, too, I think are more prone to this. And this is where I think I've seen cooperative games getting better in their design. I think a lot of co-op game designers are thinking about how can I build this game in a way that solves this problem.
Right.
Sort of having perfect information out there.
Right.
Is one of those problems. I often wonder whether that's why Pandemic Legacy, I used to kind of snigger at that rule that says you have to keep your cards. You can tell other people what cards you have in your hand.
Right.
But you have to keep them held up. I think that's maybe the reason is because they understood from even, you know, even those designers understood if you just have perfect information around the table, there's going to be one person who just tries to puzzle it all and force everybody into that.
Yep.
Into that plan.
And I have been that person, and it may be satisfying for that person, but to that person of which I have been one, this is getting confusing. I would say, dude, go play a solo game.
Right.
That's not what a cooperative game is for. Okay. And I have to check myself. Whether I'm hosting a game night or whether I'm playing a game with some folks, I have to check myself. Like, you know what? You're not playing it to be the most optimized version of this game ever and win it for historical notoriety. You're trying to have an experience with these other people. So quit it, knock it off, because you're screwing that up. But a good cooperative game design will minimize my need to tell myself, knock it off.
So as we talk about cooperative game design, when we put together the spreadsheet, I tried to, and I went down and just kind of put a type and a subtype for each of these cooperative games. I realized, you know, Board Game Geek, I could have pulled the information there, but I just wanted to kind of maybe put my own wording to it.
Sure.
You know, I've heard the term crisis management used for a lot of co-op games, and I think that that's a pretty accurate term for a great many of them, and for all of them have some kind of problem to solve. And if for many of them, it's sort of like this really high pressure impending crisis that must be solved right now. For some of them, it's a little bit more obvious, like Space Alert. I mean, you're flying a ship, you're getting battered by other ships, you're getting saboteurs and aliens or even somehow sneaking into your ship, and you've got to, it's just dealing with crisis after crisis. And the point of the game isn't even necessary to solve the problem. You're just trying to limp your ship home without having it, the damage completely destroy the hull on any one side of your ship. That's it. That to me is almost like the most pure sort of crisis management, because there is no other objective other than to just to survive this onslaught.
Right. Or Samurai Spirit, where each one of you will have to engage with dozens of warriors so that your homes can stay standing.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
You know, there are other games that have a little bit sort of crisis management mixed in with other sort of mechanics. I think Flashpoint Fire Rescue is one of these. I mean, clearly the fire is a crisis you're trying to manage.
Right.
But you're also trying to solve this puzzle and also complete an objective of going along and rescuing these victims from the fire that you don't know are victims until you reach that point and examine. Sometimes it's a little critter and sometimes it's a human being and sometimes it's nothing. But so crisis management, I'm just saying it's a pretty broad term that we would use, but we see them across the board. What's interesting to me, though, is that there are some games that have come out that have sort of broken the crisis management mold.
Yeah, I would say crisis management is what most people think of when they think of cooperative games.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also say that in the last couple of years, we've seen designers start to subvert that expectation. And if you are not aware of non-crisis management cooperative games, you're kind of selling yourself short here, because some of them are a totally different experience than, say, a Pandemic or a Samurai Spirit or Flashpoint Fire Rescue. There are some games out there that are really wacky.
Yeah, offhand, I can't think of any. I'm kidding. Give us some examples, man.
Man, I set you up for that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I was trying to be nice and let you do some work. Awesome.
Something about escalators, so. A mace.
Oh, yeah. Okay, magic maze. This is the one we just got on the table here recently. And are really enjoying Magic Maze. I suppose, like, you do have that timed element, so it's real time, and that's another category of I'll take a quick aside, because that's also on our list here. That's another category of cooperative games, ones that you have a timer for. That one that I mentioned, Space Alert, actually has a soundtrack that goes along with the game, so it's only going to last 10 minutes and then it's over. Escape the Cursed. The Curse of the Temple, is that what it's called?
Yeah. Kitchen Rush is another one, the more recent one that's come out recently.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's timed?
Oh, yeah.
Ah, wow. Okay. I know nothing about the game other than seeing the covers. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, but this one that we've played, Magic Maze, is really an interesting game, and it's very innovative. And I think it deserves a play just because, and a look from you, just because of how different it is. We were looking at actually even the core mechanic. It does something that I've never seen another cooperative game do, which is you have four player pawns that you're moving around, but those players don't correspond to any one player. You have an action in front of you that moves a guy a different direction or performs a certain kind of special action. And you can perform, you're doing all this in real time, because what you're doing is you start off on this one square. You move these pawns around. You explore more squares. You get them to the item that they're supposed to steal from the shopping mall. When you get all four of them on their items, then it's a matter of getting them to their exit. But I can't move them up, down, left, and right. I only have the down movement. So I can move them down.
Right.
And then it may be that Andrew has the left movement or the up movement. But he's not seeing what I'm trying to do. He's focusing on another objective. He's focusing on some other thing on the map. And so I've got to get his attention to move my guy the direction that he has in front of him. So what you do is you take this big attention pawn and you tap it in front of the player that you want to do something. And of course,
you have a bunch
of players who want a bunch of other players to do something. And so you're tapping the pawn in front of them. It just really makes for a very interesting game. But this is a game that from its mechanics to its ideas is just so totally different. And I wouldn't call this crisis management per se. It's just timed objective completion.
It's timed, because you even have the opportunity to extend your timer. If you're savvy, you can go to those special spaces to flip the timer and give yourself more time. It's not like Escape or Space Alert where you've got that fixed amount of time that you have to complete it in.
Right.
This is a little bit, it's puzzly, but the time is there to make you mess up if you think too much about what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, credit to the Spiel des Jahres committee. That was a Spiel des Jahres recommendee last year.
Right.
Actually, the one that won it in 2013. I know this has gotten a ton of buzz, but Hanabi. Hanabi takes that hidden information aspect. Okay, this totally neutralizes the quarterbacking player because they can't even see what they have in their hand. I love this game for that puzzle. The restrictions are so tight and the types of hints you can give are so limiting. You just all kind of are collectively breaking your brains against this very simple puzzle. You know, Hanabi is literally multiplayer solitaire. You're just trying to play down to five tableaus, five different suits down on the table in front of you, and you're trying to do it in order, but you can't see your own cards. This is genius. A couple other games do this. Code 777 by Alex Randolph is one. Then there's almost a deduction mystery murder one with clue-like elements where you're trying to figure out a whodunit. I can't remember the name of that one. There's a couple others that have taken this hidden information from yourself, but yeah, Hanabi, it's available for $10. Nice little cooperative game that really forces you to work together because not any one of you has all the pieces to this puzzle.
So what are some other kind of broad categories. So we've broken like crisis management. We've talked about some of these other like objective completion. Hanabi, actually, it has a mechanic, a type that I don't think I have seen in any other deck builder, which is tableau building, group tableau building. I mean, there may be some out there. And guys, if you're listening to this, feel free to comment. Some other ones that I would say, and this is kind of related to crisis management, but boss battle, where the whole goal is that you're going to be fighting this big baddie and you've got to get his health down to zero before he gets everybody else's health down to zero.
Right.
Level 99 Games is, Greater Than Games is a company that does a lot of this with Sentinels of the Multiverse, there's kind of a space version of that too that wasn't terribly critically acclaimed. I have it, but I actually haven't played it yet. There's also, Aeon's End, which is by them as well, that I think is a probably the best sort of boss battle game that I've seen. What are some others, Andrew, that you would bring out, like just broad categories of
co-ops? Mystery games.
Okay.
You know, one of my favorites is Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. That's a co-op that takes you in a very unique direction because you're all working together to solve this mystery. Mm-hmm. Well, it's in the title. Mysterium is another one from that category where you're all kind of working together to solve a mystery.
Right.
You know, those can be really fun where you're all kind of in Sherlock Holmes. It's a story based puzzle that you're trying to understand. In Mysterium, it's a combination based puzzle that you're trying to solve. But those can be very interesting.
Campaign games are another one. My son and I just broke out Castle Ravenloft. It's been on my shelf for a while. We broke it out this last week and played several games of it and are having a great time with it. And it is just kind of a co-op dungeon crawl where we're both truly playing against just the board, not against another person.
Obligatory Grimslingers reference at this point in time. That's another campaign-based cooperative game. There's a competitive mode, but it's garbage. Go play the co-op version. It's very, very good.
And since I did bring up Castle Ravenloft, another similar game, campaign game, would take us into another realm of categories of co-ops, one versus many. And I'm thinking of the game Descent.
Okay.
So where one person plays the Overlord and you have these, every other player plays a hero or sometimes two that is trying to basically complete various objectives in the campaign. A notable difference in Descent and Castle Ravenloft is that you have, you know, permanent leveling up that will affect future games.
Right.
So, you know, that's kind of an interesting approach to it as well.
Okay, so hold up a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Hold up a minute. Let's rabbit trail this thing a bit. We might have to get back to the core definition of what is a co-op.
Oh, yeah, that's
right. You were giving me grief the other day for saying that a one versus many is a co-op.
And I realize this may be, I'm not sure even on BGG, if a game like Spectre Ops or Fury of Dracula is categorized as a co-op. I think they're categorized as hidden movement, one versus many. I don't think they're technically categorized as cooperative. And I think it's okay for us to be a little bit different.
Yeah.
that said, go ahead.
Okay. So here's my impassioned defense for the one versus many as a co-op.
Mm-hmm.
I'm staring right at one right now on the table in front of me, not alone. It's a tiny little co-op game that plays in about 30 minutes, but one player plays the beast. And while every other player is trying to escape the beast is trying to devour all the other players. So this doesn't seem to be a co-op because you have a clear two sides. But the way I understand it is the beast is an extension of the game. What's the main group that's playing? It's the survivors. It's the ones who are trying to escape the beast. They're working together. They're cooperating. They're trying to outwit the game, still the game. It's just that the game is using another person to provide some unpredictability. You know, there's unpredictability that's there that would never be there if it were a deck of cards that explained how the monster was going to react. The fact that it's another human makes it tense, makes it snappy. For this particular game, that's an excellent choice. It's still totally a co-op game for the other side, though, for the humans. So I almost view it as, and when I play as the beast or as a host my game night, I'm playing the part of the game. I'm making sure that that group has a good time by me trying to defeat them, which sounds odd, but I still consider it a co-op. And maybe I'm cutting against the grain here, but I still think that sort of one versus many game is definitely a co-op, even when you're playing on two different sides.
And there are different levels of one versus many.
Right.
Like Shadows Over Camelot is widely regarded as a cooperative game because all you have on the other side is a traitor. He's not really running the game.
Right.
He's just trying to ruin the game, but he doesn't actually control. He's not the AI that's controlling everything that's going on. He'll have some influence over the AI when he reveals himself. But for the most part, he's just kind of there to throw a monkey wrench into the works.
So I would say that Hidden Traitor is absolutely a co-op, even more so than One Versus Many, you know?
But something that kind of proves your point is Mansions of Madness. The new version
uses an app.
Yeah. And not a person.
Right.
My understanding is the old person. I haven't played Mansions of Madness.
Right.
But my understanding is that the old version of the game, one person had to, in essence, play the Overlord.
Interesting.
They've replaced that with an AI on the app.
Hmm.
So even that game is sort of demonstrative of your point exactly.
Right.
It's there's an AI needed in a co-op game. Sometimes a player plays it.
Right.
Sometimes a deck of cards will play it. Sometimes an app will play it.
Yeah.
So,
and a lot of times, you know, a game will tell you to go back to the cooperate versus coerce debate. A lot of times, say in Pandemic, I can feel hemmed in because the board game basically says, this is the path you need to follow.
Mm-hmm.
All of you need to follow this path. That kind of forces cooperation. That's coercion in a cooperative game. I find that these ones that mix in that human element, that's where the true cooperation gets fostered. And I'm talking true cooperation, not just playing by the game's rules, but sussing out the other players, figuring out like, okay, we've got to work together here.
Right.
We're all good on balance, but there's evil amongst us. And how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to react to that? That's a social dynamic. That's training people how to react in social situations, whether that's work or, you know, it's not so extreme as a traitor trying to sabotage something, but that teaches you how to interact with people. That's really cool.
Right.
That a game can do that and that you can all have fun doing that and still pick up some social skills along the way.
So the long and the short of it is we're calling One Versus Many games cooperative.
Yeah, I am at least.
So just for the sake of this podcast and our own framework of conversation. But that said, bluntly, that's a realm I haven't played a lot of games in. I think the only One Versus Many games I've played are Descent, Shadows Over Camelot, and Tragedy Looper.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's it.
Tragedy Looper makes that distinction even more obvious because it actually calls the one player a game master.
Right.
You know, you're not even playing the same game as the group. You know, another example that springs to mind is Mysterium, where the game master happens to be on the same side as the other team, but can't communicate with them.
Right.
You know, you're not even playing the same game. That's a totally different experience. You are an extension and tool of the game. You're not even experiencing it in the same way the other players are.
Well, back from that aside,
a couple of
other categories, and I would say these are broad and they can be combined with some of the other categories, are puzzle solvers. Every co-op game to some degree is a puzzle. I heard somebody talk about Forbidden Desert not too long ago saying that it's an interesting sort of cooperative puzzle. And that's an interesting way to put it.
Interesting is debatable.
It's a crisis management game. Yeah, Andrew's not a fan of it. I actually really like it, but I do think it's a puzzle. It's a tactical puzzle. Yeah, you kind of have to respond to what's going on. But I think there are enough interesting choices to make, and I think it's a whole lot better than its predecessor, Forbidden Island, which is just, it's so easy. It's just, there's not much puzzle to the puzzle. Forbidden Desert sort of ratchets up that crisis management so that you have the sand in the desert to deal with. You have the sun beating down and the water problem to deal with. So, and you have the shifting tiles to deal with and digging through the sand to find the pieces. So there are a lot of, there are a lot of just really bad things that give you a lot of, I think, interesting choices to make. But I would agree with you. At the end of the day, that one feels more like a puzzle than it does a crisis.
And I would say for me personally, the puzzle co-ops, Matt Leacock is the founder here, I would say, and nothing against him. I think a lot of people love his games. They're not for me. Those types of co-ops don't grab me. And I think the reason is They just don't have that element that I personally am looking for. And it's that camaraderie. The sense in Forbidden Desert is that there's just too much here for one person to do. So we all know what needs to be done, but there's more here than can be done by one person. So we need four of us. There's no sense that we're all working on different angles of the problem, or we bring something unique to the table, or by our combined forces. A token ability. I'm not convinced by it. And even, okay, so if I am going to play a game like this, I'd want it to be really short and snappy. I'd actually prefer Forbidden Island to Forbidden Desert because of its length. Something like Samurai Spirit would be my ideal. Done in 15 minutes. That same concept, you're all kind of doing the same thing. There's just more there than any one of you can handle.
Yeah, I guess when we play Forbidden Desert, it's usually just my wife and myself, and the games are over in 30. Okay. We know what we're doing, so it's kind of... And I would agree with you. It doesn't give you that epic crisis feel that Space Alert or some of these other games do. It's more of that puzzle feel, but it's a puzzle we enjoy solving.
Yeah, and that does bring up something else I want to touch on. Because of their nature, because you're playing against the game for the most part in co-ops, I find that they're more static. I said this at the beginning. I think that the experience is whatever's been designed to be in the box. Some people look at that as a drawback. I don't necessarily. If I open up Samurai Spirit, I know exactly what I'm going to get. And as a game night host, that's a very valuable tool to have in my arsenal when I can read the crowd and say, if I pull out Samurai Spirit, I know how it's going to go down. That I can't say that for a competitive game or a few competitive games.
Right.
You know, but a cooperative game, because it is return to that same puzzle, sure, does it have the infinite replayability that a competitive game has? No, but it serves a different purpose. And that's why I have so many co-op games in my collection. I know the purpose they serve, and that's valuable. They are a tool in my arsenal when I'm hosting because I know... Here's what the experience is going to be with this game, because it is a puzzle and people can really have fun on that. There doesn't need to be a new and fresh experience every time. And that's a place where I've changed my opinion. So maybe it's been playing through Pandemic Legacy, but I've kind of come to this realization. Co-ops don't have to be eternally fresh or anything like that.
Right.
It's the fact that they're a static experience sometimes that makes them so valuable.
I agree. And with my wife, and this is just her personality, she prefers that puzzle. It gives her the feeling of being in control when she can think and puzzle her way through it and take her time. And so again, that's why Bastion is so interesting to us. And it's we'll hit this in the mechanics session a little bit, but Bastion actually is a pickup and deliver. I just realized it today. A cooperative game. It's all it is just an efficiency puzzle. And if you do things in the most efficient way, you're going to win the game.
Yeah.
But we like that. It's predictable to some degree? Yes, but it's still an interesting puzzle for us to solve.
My example for that would be Codenames Duet, which I cannot believe I left off this list. It just came to me right now. Cooperative clue giving in a totally different way from Hanabi, but still a clue giving mechanic. And yeah, it's the same experience every time. And yet, my wife and I have played it 50 times because we toss it in her purse when we go out on a date, when we're sitting waiting for our food to come. We play a couple rounds of Codenames Duet. We've developed our own personal metagame, just the two of us. We know what sorts of hints the other gives, what things they pick up on. It's the same experience every time, but it's good.
Right.
And we love it, and we have fun together. So, I think that's an underrated strength of cooperative games.
Let's talk about now the mechanics of cooperative games. What are some of the most common mechanics? And we're kind of rehashing a little bit for the listener, rehashing probably some of what they inherently already know. But I think it's interesting to talk about anyway. Some of the mechanics that are just incredibly common out there, and you'll find them in so many games.
Right.
Action point allocation,
probably
the very, very first one. You know, Pandemic was, I don't know if that was the first co-op game to do it, but it had to be among the first.
Definitely the most prominent.
And so many other games use it that I've actually turned down the opportunity to get into some co-ops. Like Defenders of the Realm actually looks really interesting to me just for its theme. But I'm thinking, do I really want another action point allocation co-op? I have so many of them already.
See, I would pick one of those. just roll with it.
Yeah.
So maybe that is Defenders of the Realm. Maybe that's Pandemic. But I agree. I think that's one of the most common things you see. I mean, that's why anyone who's played Pandemic can pick up Forbidden Island or Forbidden Desert.
Right.
You have four actions. You can move. You can do things, you know, what have you.
Right. And arguably, I'm not saying that should, just because you have one action point allocation co-op, that you should, you not play any other one the rest of your life. The fact is, some good ones will continue to come out. But I would just say to the gamer, you should be a little bit cautious, because a lot of games in the action point allocation realm are just variants of others, and they're not really bringing anything new to the table. They're just sort of standing on the shoulders of giants to kind of repackage and redeliver something that they know works. Another mechanic that's very common is sort of the way that the game is timed, usually like from a deck of cards. Yeah. Is that really the main way I've seen co-op games timed? Primarily, yeah. If you think of like Pandemic,
Hanabi, Samurai Spirit,
right,
The Grizzled,
right.
It's a nice way to do it. Whether it's a finite deck, something like Hanabi, where you run out, you're done, or Samurai Spirit, where when you run out, you've completed it successfully, or Pandemic style of kind of shuffling in the main milestones, the epidemics in Pandemic's case. You know, the deck of cards is a useful way to stand in for a human game master. It's a game master that's pre-programmed for you.
But if you've been turned off by co-ops because of sort of some of the sameness of a lot of these mechanics, I think there is some good news out there. There are some games that really break the mold. What do you got? What do you got?
It's
you got
time one? For a Sherlock Holmes plug.
All right, go for it.
Okay, so I've never played a game like this.
Mm-hmm.
You open a book, you read a case, Sherlock's on it. He's going to do it in 3-4 leads. You're going to do it in 28 if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
This is a game where you just walk around and do stuff. You say, hey, we want to go to Buckingham Palace. Okay, so you turn to the book to the number where Buckingham Palace is, and you see if there's a clue there, and you see if you get closer to solving the mystery, and you just walk around until you decide you know what happened, and then you go back to Baker Street, and you listen to Holmes lay it out so perfectly, and well, of course, you know, I was able to deduce that from this, and you just kind of seethe inside because he's so much smarter than you are, and it's just a really fun way. Such an open-ended game, it could almost be called an activity. But in terms of fostering cooperation and interaction amongst the players, I've seen few better. I've played this from 2 players to 8 players, and I just love it for its ability to tell a story for a group.
This game sounds like, if you've never played it, it probably sounds like if you ever bought one of those puzzle books that had like logic puzzles in it, where, you know, a Farmer Brown has 6 animals in his barn and, you know, how many ducks and how many. So it sounds almost like a combination of that and a choose your own adventure book. And that combination probably doesn't sound terribly good to you. But the thing that clinched it for me was the night that I came over to your game night, but I came over a little bit late. Mm-hmm. And you guys were already well into a Sherlock Holmes adventure. So my son and I just played Summoner Wars on the side while you guys were going at it.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. Your friends who would probably not sit down in front of either a logic puzzle or a choose your own adventure book, right, were loving this game. The game is a well-written story and puzzle kind of mixed together. And we need more of these kinds of games.
We do. It's a crime that this is the best example we have.
Right.
Kudos to Space Cowboys for bringing out new boxes. I think they're up to 3 now. So that's 30 cases. And there have been other cases published, and I'm sure they're working on more. But let's see a game innovate on this system. Let's see a game build on this system, use this, and maybe not as the central element, but as some mechanic. You know, surely we could see this sort of location-based clue-giving story game. Surely we could see that expressed in another game.
Another mechanic that I think is interesting, that I only know of 2 cooperative games that do it, is programming.
Yeah.
Now, the programming mechanic was probably made most famous by Robo Rally. A game that I don't really like, and because I didn't like that, I didn't think that I would like Space Alert. But Space Alert, and it's not a terribly new game, it's been out for a while, but it uses programming. And of course, Mechs versus Minions has come in behind it, and it's sitting on my shelf unplayed. We've got
to
get that open.
Which I still
open.
Need to play. Yeah, we need to.
Man,
we need to
get
crack
that game open.
But you're killing me.
And that, well, both of those games actually kind of merge the real time element with programming,
yeah.
which is good. But I'd like to see more of these games out there. I think we're still just on the very front end,
yeah.
of programming games. Any other mechanics that you'd like to see more of that you've?
I'd like to see more. I liked what Magic Maze did. Mm-hmm. It made an asymmetric, truly asymmetric game. In the case of Magic Maze, it's a very light game. Right. You know, you all just control a different cardinal direction, but it doesn't have to be light. What if we saw true asymmetry, something like Vast the Crystal Caverns, dare I say it, in a cooperative game? Wouldn't that be interesting?
Right.
You know, some sort of true. So, yeah, a cooperative game, a lot of times you can all do the same thing, and it's by strength of numbers, spreading out to different locations on a map. Or sometimes you'll have one player power that lets you do something a little bit better than other people, but you're still all doing similar things. What if we saw true asymmetry, you know, in a cooperative game? That would be really cool for me. I would love to see that.
In Magic Maze, it's not the asymmetry that grabs me as much as the fact that everybody is trying to be one brain.
Yeah.
It's sort of like four people with their legs tied together, sort of in like one of those, you know, those races you run at a fair or something,
yeah.
where two people tie their legs together, right? Imagine like four players or eight players around the table, each with, you know, their right to left leg tied together, and they're trying to run a race. That's exactly what Magic Maze is,
yeah.
and that's what makes it so fun.
The only other co-op game that I've seen that does that is the little word game called Shh, which
is
very simple. You just play a letter from your hand. You guys have to build a word in the center, but you can't talk. That not talking part is the rub. You'd think it'd be very simple. Just build a word, right? But you have one word in mind, and she has one word in mind, and he has another word in mind. And then, you know, at some point, someone just has to vote and call it a word. But maybe someone else had a letter that could let it go longer, and you're trying to play all the letters out of your hand, and you can't talk. It has that same feeling of we just have to think as one. And let me tell you, you think you know someone, like, for example, my wife. You think you know someone, and then you play that game with them, and you realize, oh, you don't know a thing about them. You don't know a thing about how their brain works.
Restricted clue giving is another thing that you're kind of leading.
Hanabi has that same
Hanabi, Magic Maze, Mysterium. It's all like restricted communication that happens or can't happen, and that makes the game really a lot more interesting.
Oh, I love that. I mean, man, you were laughing more than I've seen you laugh in months playing Magic Maze.
Oh,
even Mysterium,
man.
You watch the ghost's face just torture. Yeah. When I play the ghost, I have to cover my eyes because I'll give stuff away because I'm just, come on, I gave you something obvious and you're missing it and I can't talk.
Yeah.
Boy, I love that. That really... That is a great way to kickstart a fun time.
Well, you know, it really is interesting to look at some of these mechanics and realize that co-op gaming still has not plumbed near the depths that competitive gaming has. And I think that's cool.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that means we're going to see, as game designers get more on board with cooperative games, I think they're just going to become more smarter, more innovative. And I can't wait to see what comes down the pike in the next few
and
years.
And on an industry note, this is how the hobby is going to grow. Okay?
Yeah.
This hobby is not going to grow heavy euros. There are more people playing heavy euros than there were 10 years ago. That's great. I love heavy euros. I'm not saying anything bad against them. Families.
You like some heavy euros.
Oh, man. I've been eyeing Lisboa, though.
Okay.
I like heavy euros. I need the right one, but I like them.
Yeah.
But, you know, your average Joe, this is a great way to show them, look at how much fun you can have around a table. With people that you maybe don't even know. So what I love about co-ops, they're just a lot of fun. So maybe we could talk about, you know, what are these elements that just make or break a co-op for you? What is that fun element in co-ops that really grabs you?
This was really an elusive thing for me because as I made my spreadsheet, as somebody who spent many years as a software analyst, you know, a software engineer, I'm kind of expecting the answer to be in the data.
Uh-huh.
And in the end, when I put the fun factor on the right of the spreadsheet, and I tried to find the commonalities between the types, the subtypes, the timer of the game, the key mechanics, and I put down what drove the fun and put down the fun factor, it occurred to me that there was no commonality.
Right.
In other words, just because a game was a programming game or a one versus many game did not mean that it always struck with me. And I guess in a way, I shouldn't have expected it to be any different, right?
Right.
It's like any other game. Sometimes a game just has a certain magic that comes together.
Yeah.
And it's just a combination of elements. And it is a bit subjective.
Yeah.
It's fun for me, but it might not be fun for another person who doesn't get into that so much. Okay, perfect example of this. My son and I mentioned this earlier in the podcast, are having an epic time playing Castle Ravenloft. Yes, we're being complete geeks about this. I'm pulling up Spotify. I'm looking up Dungeons and Dragons playlist.
There you go.
Setting it to play. We're like, you know, getting into our characters and, you know, making hand motions as we cast spells.
Yeah.
And we're really getting into this theme. It is really thematic. You feel like you're in a dungeon and you feel desperate as these monsters come at you. Yes, it's very simplistic. Doesn't have the line of sight, the continual character leveling like Descent does. But we don't like Descent because, well, first of all, we're the only two playing this game. And when we have to play Descent, one player plays the Overlord and the other one plays a couple of heroes. And it's just not as fun. This game just gave us that really epic feeling of sort of being on the same team against all this stuff coming at us without having to put on a full Dungeons and Dragons campaign.
Yeah.
So if it were themed differently, would I like it as much? Probably not.
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't feel as epic. In this case, theme made up for what the game may lack mechanically.
Yeah. I would return to that idea of a co-op as a static puzzle. In many senses, you know what you're going to get. So you find a couple that really grab you for one reason or another, whether it's an innovative mechanic or a great theme or, you know, some specific thing that you're doing in the game, and you return to those again and again. You return to them and you just know this is going to be a good time. I don't play Hanabi often, but I know exactly what I'm getting into every time I play it, and I love it. That's why it'll never leave my collection. I love the feelings of desperation and ingenuity that it provokes, you know, and so I'll keep it in my collection, even though I only play it twice a year or something like that, because it's a little bit stressful. But I enjoy that experience, and I love that experience.
What are some that you would say, like, the sum of what they are just adds up to a great experience for you? I know we're kind of delving into territory that we would normally do in a pick five.
Yeah.
But I think that it's appropriate for this topic. I mean, we've laid out a lot of those factors. And I think it's worth giving some of our opinions about maybe some of those ones that just really hit our top.
I love a cooperative game that I'm sitting around the table playing with someone who's never played one of these games before. And all of a sudden, wait, I can do this and this. I can get us out of this. Or I have this special power that lets us do this. Or wait, you shouldn't do that because I can come save you. And all of a sudden they get it. I just contributed to this. I just helped us win. Maybe someone who's never picked up a board game in their life before, but they get that.
Yeah.
And they have this feeling where it's just awesome because I helped. I was smart. You know, and that's not a feeling that they were aware that board games could provoke. And then we finish it and I high five them. I said, that was awesome, man. And I don't care if I just met them or if I've been their friend for years.
Right.
That is a great feeling, that camaraderie, especially as it relates to, you know, I enjoy a co-op, but I know what they have to offer. For someone who that first time, they're just like, whoa, this is really cool. We're all striving together towards this. And then they finish and they say, we got to play that again.
Yeah.
Man, I love that. That is the best moment as a game night host. That is what I'm looking for. And I love it when that realization just clicks into people.
And what's even more fun is when that enthusiasm isn't forced on your part because you saw it too. Like it was
right.
See, there are some co-op games where the more you play them, the obvious path is the obvious path. I mean, and you know it, and you're just waiting for the other player to make that decision.
Right.
What's fun is when that's sort of like in the play, when the game is complex enough
mm-hmm.
that that's really, it yeah. took five heads looking at it
right.
for one person to come up and say, if I did this and another player chimes in, then this could happen. Then right. I could do this.
Exactly.
Like that is what really makes
exactly.
it. So what are some games like that that you've played?
Oh, man.
If you're having difficulty, I could pull one off while you're thinking.
I'm having difficulty because I've seen games that hit that at times, but I don't think I have a single game that could hit that reliably.
Yeah.
Even something like Sherlock Holmes or Escape Curse of the Temple, both of which I love, both of which I rate a 10, I've seen it go the other way. And maybe that's just in the nature of games, but those would be two I'd throw off the top of my head. I love both of those for that.
I've only gotten one play of this game in, Robinson Crusoe.
Mm.
But it has a lot of that. It's just so, there are so many things you're having to juggle and manage that very often you'll have that player just, or I'd say very often in the game that we played,
yeah.
that, you know, a player would pipe up and say, wait a second, you know, if I do this, then on your turn you could do this and maybe we can kill this beast and, because I have this card and, but we'd have to get a lucky dice roll to do it. Okay, let's try it. Let's make it happen.
Right.
And I kind of like that. That brought out some of that in me.
I take it back. I do know of one.
Lay it on me.
This one I also rate a 10. I'm a big fan of a lot of co-ops. Shadows over Camelot.
Yeah.
Has this in spades. And you know what? That game, the deck of cards that is in it is a masterpiece because unlike Pandemic, I know what's coming every time. The location, the timing may vary a bit. It's going to be the same thing almost every time. Shadows, you do not know. Just depending on the shuffle of the cards, you could have one quest be super hard that game and super easy the next game. Or you could have, you know, a ton of warrior cards come out in quick succession so that you lose the Saxon and Pict quest and all of a sudden you're facing a bunch of black swords on the table and you're, you know, I've had games of this where we just kind of cruise to an easy finish only for the traitor to snap reveal everything.
Mm.
Or I've had games of this where everything's lost from the very beginning and we just kind of have to scrape together all our resources to even stay in the game.
Right.
It's a different experience every time, but I've seen it. I've seen it bring people to life. This is a game that we bring out often and even with new gamers and they see it. They see it and they love that experience and they have something to contribute. That would definitely be my pick. If I had to pick, it kills me to say this over games like Sherlock Holmes, but if I had to pick only one cooperative game to play for the rest of my life, it would still be Shadows.
That's the only co-op game on my list that's rated at a 10.
Yep.
There are some other games that I think are worth mentioning for their cooperative element, although I don't think they necessarily have those aha moments, but Sentinels of the Multiverse has some of those where you're like, I have this kind of card in my hand.
Right.
What if I do this on my turn and take out these two? And then on your turn, if you can hit these two, and then do you have the card that and so you're constantly asking each other about how you're going to take down the minions so you can finally get to the boss? That's one of them. But Aeon's End, though, is to me just almost perfection in this.
Yeah.
The variable player powers are so strongly different that they really control how you play the game. And I've played games where I've cast almost no spells because it was my job to be the guy who, I forget his name, but who heals Gravehold constantly.
Right.
And so I'm playing as a support player
right.
to another player who's casting all the spells that heal us, to another player who's casting all the spells that damage the boss, to another player who is casting a few spells, but he's trying to pump up his power to cancel the bad enemy cards that come out.
Right.
And that, to me, is so fun. It's like we each have a job to do.
Yep.
And, yeah, there are going to be times where we have to do some of the same stuff, but it sort of keeps us in each other's business in a way that doesn't step on each other's toes.
Right.
And I don't – so far in Aeon's End, I haven't experienced an alpha player problem. And I think it's because just, you know your role. You know
right.
what you're supposed to do.
Right.
And you specialize. And that's
right.
that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, that has been our – cooperative extravaganza. We stretched this one to a whole episode because we had a ton of co-ops we wanted to mention. We wanted to kind of dig into the meat of these different cooperative mechanics. Ultimately, we just wanted to think about what makes co-ops fun for us. And I can say for me, it's all about the people. It's all about the group. I want the group to have a fun time. I want them to work together. I want them to enjoy each other's company. And I want them to go home saying, man, I have great friends. That was a fun time.
Mm-hmm. And I would echo that, except that for me, it's all about me and what makes me happy and controlling the other players. No, that's not true. Andrew is absolutely right on this. It does boil down to what is fun for you and your friends. And for me, that's different sometimes than what you and your friends enjoy.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
I have more friends than you. So sometimes the discussions are different.
But I have better friends. No. You will notice that there was one noticeable exception from our list. That was Pandemic Legacy.
Review is coming.
Really in a sort of a category all its own. And the reason we left off discussion of it today is because we are going to be doing a review of that in our next podcast for you. We're going to try to do it in a way, you know, I've heard reviews done of this in a way that prevents spoilers from occurring. I would say that, though, my problem with that has been sometimes those reviews are so generic.
They don't say anything.
That they don't say anything about the game. I am planning on saying a bit.
Yeah.
Nothing that gives away specifics, but enough that gives away enough about the mechanics that if you haven't played Pandemic Legacy and you've been on the fence, hopefully it won't be a spoiler, but some of the magic in it, we just want to delve into maybe a little bit more than surface.
And we know we're 3 years late on this.
But we're also 3 years late to playing it.
That's true.
We're not the only people.
That's true. It's still worth playing.
It's still worth playing. And we'll be doing a review on that very soon.
Recent plays.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Magic Maze.
Okay, yeah, which we talked about a bit. Yeah. I've got one which I'm itching to get out because it's Kathala and it's Days of Wonder, and I really want to talk about it. Yamatai.
I just got the chance to play. That's a vegetarian dish with that white sauce. No? Oh, sorry. What is it?
Yamatai. Mm-hmm. It is a game about building buildings in ancient Japan, I believe. Gorgeous as per Days of Wonder. And what I love about this is kind of like Magic Maze, it subverts the idea of ownership. So there's five different colors of boats, but those are materials. So you've got bamboo boats, which are the cheapest, all the way up to gold boats, which are the most valuable. I don't know how a gold boat floats. Don't ask me. Basically, you're laying out these boats on this interwoven board of islands, and you're trying to build these buildings, which all require a certain combination of boats. So maybe one building will require a gold boat, a brick boat, and two bamboo boats, and it's worth 5 points. But no one owns the boats. So each turn, you have to put out boats, but you might be opening up a possibility for someone else. This is sort of like Through the Desert kind of has a similar... This feels almost like Kanitzia, which is maybe why I liked it so much. You don't own the stuff that you're playing on the board. The only thing you own is when you actually successfully build a building. And that's the main way you're going to score points in this game, by building buildings out on the board. And man, I just loved the strategy that went into playing stuff out on the board that helped you, but wasn't so obvious about it, because of course the buildings come from a public supply. So anyone can build the building that you might be eyeing. So you have to be obscure about what your intentions are, but you can't bank boats from round to round. You can only save one boat each time. So you just kind of have this weird puzzle of how much do I put out there to help myself without helping everyone else? And there's this really innovative turn selection mechanic, and the better the cards that give you more boats will put you further back in turn order for the next round. So you could take a really crappy, just one bamboo boat and guarantee a first turn next time. Or you could take a gold boat and any other boat of your choice, but go number 10 and be guaranteed the last spot in turn order. And those will shuffle throughout the game, so you'll be seeing them constantly. Really interesting blend of mechanics. And then the final dollop that it throws on here is kind of like how Five Tribes had the djinns. This throws in specialists, which help you subvert the rules in small ways, and sometimes will give you points or make you better at one certain thing than other people. We played a three-player match of this, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Do you think three is the right number for this game?
Possibly. I would play it with four, I think. The map felt tight, but again, when none of you own the stuff on the map, short of the buildings that you actually build, you know, the tightness isn't as much of a problem.
man, I was just really intrigued by this one. I'd have to play it again before I would say that I loved it, but it definitely just tickled my brain in an interesting way. I liked that puzzle out on the map of trying to read your opponent's intentions. And yeah, it was very interesting. That's Yamatai by Bruno Catala, published by Days of Wonder.
Very cool. Well, recent plays for me, unfortunately, have already been covered this podcast. The new game that we pulled out, Castle Ravenloft, I've already talked about quite a bit. Also, Bastion, my wife and I continue to play through the campaign. We're on the very last one of it. I'll pull out. I know we often talk about Smash Up, but we pulled out Smash Up last night and had a really great game. It's great because I won. No, well, it still was a great game.
Oh, there's a recent play you're neglecting, Tim.
Oh, really? What is that?
Yeah, it's a recent play of a game that I taught you and you didn't necessarily enjoy. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that game.
Oh, my goodness. I'm not remembering
it. I'm not going to name any names, but it starts with V and ends with Ast.
Oh, my goodness. Vast. Okay.
So lay it on me.
Vast was really interesting.
Yeah.
I loved the asymmetry. I loved the artwork. I loved the mechanics of what you were doing. In the end, though, I think I may end up loving Vast for what it tried to do and for its historical positioning in board gaming. Yeah. Than for a game that I found that I could replay over and right. over. But I don't know that yet after one play.
Yeah, yeah.
And it had nothing to do with losing. It was an enjoyable game to play. But in the end, I didn't feel like any of us had enough control over the stuff we needed to do in our victory. I felt like my actions and my victory condition were a little too far removed. And there's something in that game that just unsettled me a little bit in terms of its play. And I've got to figure out what that is, but I really want to play it again. Yeah. Vast tries to be StarCraft.
Yeah.
It tries to introduce complete asymmetry.
Right.
And it does so beautifully in so many ways. It's a game that's screaming to me for a 2.0. Almost even, it even sparked a discussion between Andrew and I as to whether board games should release fixes like video games release fixes. Some people look at video game fixes and say, well, you know, they're just pushing deadlines. And so they're coming back with a fix to, you know, they're sloppy in their design and they come back with a fix. But see, that wasn't the case with StarCraft. And I remember I was in line to buy StarCraft in 1998 when it first came out, bought it from Best Buy, brought it home. And the game that I was playing 6 months later was very different from the game that I bought in terms of its balance, because they were having to constantly release fixes to it and updates to it, because there is no way to test every possible combination of what would happen with that level of asymmetry. Right. I wouldn't say Vast has nearly the characters or the options, of course, that StarCraft does, but I have some concerns about its balancing.
Yeah.
But I want to play the game again.
So you have to play the game again, A, because I'm planning on reviewing it. So whether I do that with you in audio or just as written review, that'll be up to you.
With or without you. That's what you're saying.
With or without you. Yeah.
It's come down to this.
Yeah, it's come down to this. So if you won't do it with me, then I'll just do a get on review because you're the board. So... anyways, yeah, I've played Vast 7 times now. I've played all of the base game roles multiple times, except for the knight. And I have a game lined up to play the thief, who's the fifth role who comes in the box. I've seen a little bit more of the depths. I've seen a little bit more of the problems. So I think we could do a really interesting review of this one. But yeah, I was glad that we finally got to the table that you got to try it. It's definitely a unique game, and I think it merits some exploration for that.
Who's the designer in that game?
Patrick Leader. And he is the owner of Leader Game, who published it. So they're a micro publisher out of Minneapolis, actually.
Gotcha.
And it was a Kickstarter. It's now in retail. And they are actually kickstarting now Root, which is a coin game
with that leader games asymmetry flavor on top of it. So that's by Cole Whirl. I'm pretty excited about that one. I think that might be the 2.0 that Vast needed, although it's very different in many ways. So we'll have to see. I'll have to get that one and have to try it out. But yeah, Vast, Crystal Caverns.
Well, that wraps it up for this week. As always, we welcome any questions or comments. We do have an email address now, hello@getonboard.games.
You can also get in touch with us at our Board Game Geek Guild, number 3162. We are Get On Board on Board Game Geek. You can, as always, find us on our website, www.getonboard.games, or on the iTunes and Google Play Music catalogs for podcasts. We publish new episodes every Monday and written / audio reviews every Wednesday, so be sure to tune in for those. As always, this has been Get On Board, and thanks for listening.
Bye. And really trying to get at this core question of what makes a cooperator. What makes a cooperator? What makes a cooperative game fun?